It is difficult to remember why I came here, and why I care about unburdening myself from this beautiful weight. But then, my scratching hands find it. The memory of my mother's face, and the strange angles of her limbs on the pavement, and the blood seeping from my father's body. "But they are dead," the voice says. "You could join them." "They died for me," I answer. "And now I have something to do in return. I have to stop other people from losing everything. I have to save the city and the people my mother and father loved. If I go to join my parents, I want to carry with me a good reason, not this, this senseless collapsing at the threshold. The fire, the fire. It rages within, a campfire and then an inferno, and my body is its fuel. I feel it racing through me, eating away at the weight. There is nothing that can kill me now. I am powerful and invincible and eternal. I feel the serum clinging to my skin like oil, but the darkness recedes. I slap a heavy hand over the floor and push myself up. Bent at the waist, I shove my shoulder into the double doors, and they squeak across the floor as their seal breaks. I breathe clean air and stand up straighter. I am there. I am there. But I am not alone. "Don't move," David says, raising his gun. "Hello, Triss." Chapter 50. Triss. "How did you inoculate yourself against the death serum?" he asks me.
He's still sitting in his wheelchair, but you don't need to be able to walk to fire a gun. I blink at him, still dazed.
"I didn't," I say.
"Don't be stupid," David says.
"You can't survive the death serum without an inoculation, and I'm the only person in the compound who possesses that substance."
I just stare at him, not sure what to say. I didn't inoculate myself. The fact that I'm still standing upright is impossible. There's nothing more to add.
"I suppose it no longer matters," he says.
"We're here now."
"What are you doing here?" I mumble. My lips feel awkwardly large, hard to talk around. I still feel that oily heaviness on my skin, like death is clinging to me, even though I have defeated it. I am dimly aware that I left my own gun in the hallway behind me. Sure, I wouldn't need it if I made it this far.
"I knew something was going on," David says.
"You've been running around with genetically damaged people all week, Triss. Did you think I wouldn't notice?" He shakes his head. "And then your friend Kara was caught trying to manipulate the lights. But she very wisely knocked herself out before she could tell us anything. So I came here, just in case. I'm sad to say I'm not surprised to see you."
"You came here alone?" I say.
"Not very smart, are you?" His bright eyes squint a little. "Well, you see, I have death serum resistance and a weapon, and you have no way to fight me. There's no way you can steal 4 virus devices while I have you at gunpoint. I'm afraid you've come all this way for no reason, and it will be at the expense of your life. The death serum may not have killed you, but I am going to. I'm sure you understand. Officially, we don't allow capital punishment, but I can't have you surviving this."
He thinks I'm here to steal the weapons that will reset the experiments, not deploy one of them. Of course he does. I try to guard my expression, though I'm sure it's still slack. I sweep my eyes across the room, searching for the device that will release the memory serum virus. I was there when Matthew described it to Caleb in painstaking detail earlier. A black box with a silver keypad, marked with a strip of blue tape with a model number written on it. It is one of the only items on the counter along the left wall, just a few feet away from me. But I can't move, or else he'll kill me. I'll have to wait for the right moment, and do it fast.
"I know what you did," I say. I start to back up, hoping that the accusation will distract him. "I know you designed the attack simulation. I know you're responsible for my parents' deaths, for my mother's death. I know."
"I am not responsible for her death," David says, the words bursting from him, too loud and too sudden.
"I told her what was coming just before the attack began.
so she had enough time to escort her loved ones to a safe house. If she had stayed put, she would have lived. But she was a foolish woman who didn't understand making sacrifices for the greater good, and it killed her. I frown at him. There's something about his reaction, about the glassiness of his eyes, something that he mumbled when Nita shot him with the fear serum. Something about her. "Did you love her?" I say. "All those years. She was sending you correspondence. The reason you never wanted her to stay there. The reason you told her you couldn't read her updates anymore after she married my father." David sits still, like a statue, like a man of stone. "I did," he says. "But that time is past." That must be why he welcomed me into his circle of trust, why he gave me so many opportunities, because I am a piece of her, wearing her hair and speaking with her voice. Because he has spent his life grasping at her and coming up with nothing. I hear footsteps in the hallway outside. The soldiers are coming. Good. I need them to. I need them to be exposed to the airborne serum, to pass it on to the rest of the compound. I hope they wait until the air is clear of death serum. "My mother wasn't a fool," I say. "She just understood something you didn't. That it's not sacrifice if it's someone else's life you're giving away. It's just evil." I back up another step and say, "She taught me all about real sacrifice. That it should be done from love, not misplaced disgust for another person's genetics. That it should be done from necessity, not without exhausting all other options. That it should be done for people who need your strength because they don't have enough of their own. That's why I need to stop you from sacrificing all those people and their memories. Why I need to rid the world of you, once and for all." I shake my head. "I didn't come here to steal anything, David." I twist and lunge toward the device. The gun goes off, and pain races through my body. I don't even know where the bullet hit me. I can still hear Caleb repeating the code for Matthew. With a quaking hand, I type in the numbers on the keypad. The gun goes off again. More pain, and black edges on my vision. But I hear Caleb's voice speaking again. The green button. So much pain. But how? When my body feels so numb. I start to fall, and slam my hand into the keypad on my way down. A light turns on behind the green button. I hear a beep, and a churning sound. I slide to the floor. I feel something warm on my neck. And under my cheek, red. Blood is a strange color. Dark. From the corner of my eye, I see David, slumped over in his chair. And my mother, walking out from behind him. She is dressed in the same clothes she wore the last time I saw her. Abnegation gray, stained with her blood, with bare arms to show her tattoo. There are still bullet holes in her shirt. Through them, I can see her wounded skin, red, but no longer bleeding, like she's frozen in time. Her dull blonde hair is tied back in a knot, but a few loose strands frame her face in gold. I know she can't be alive, but I don't know if I'm seeing her now because I'm delirious from the blood loss, or if the death serum has addled my thoughts, or if she is here in some other way. She kneels next to me and touches a cool hand to my cheek. "Hello, Beatrice," she says, and she smiles. "Am I done yet?" I say, and I'm not sure if I actually say it or if I just think it and she hears it. "Yes," she says, her eyes bright with tears. "My dear child, you've done so well." "What about the others?" I choke on a sob as the image of Tobias comes into my mind, of how dark and how still his eyes were, how strong and warm his hand was when we first stood face to face. "Tobias, Caleb, my friends. They'll care for each other," she says. "That's what people do." I smile and close my eyes. I feel a thread tugging me again. But this time, I know it isn't some sinister force dragging me toward death. This time, I know it's my mother's hand, drawing me into her arms. And I go gladly into her embrace. Can I be forgiven for all I've done to get here? I want to be. I can. I believe it.
Chapter 51. Tobias. Evelyn brushes the tears from her eyes with her thumb. We stand by the window, shoulder to shoulder, watching the snow swirl past. Some of the flakes gather on the windowsill outside, piling at the corners. The feeling has returned to my hands. As I stare out at the world, dusted and white, I feel like everything has begun again, and it will be better this time. I think I can get in touch with Marcus over the radio to negotiate a peace agreement, Evelyn says. He'll be listening in. He'd be stupid not to. Before you do that, I made a promise I have to keep, I say. I touch Evelyn's shoulder. I expect to see strain at the edges of her smile, but I don't. I feel a twinge of guilt. I didn't come here to ask her to lay down arms for me, to trade in everything she's worked for just to get me back. But then again, I didn't come here to give her any choice at all. I guess Triss was right. When you have to choose between two bad options, you pick the one that saves the people you love. I wouldn't have been saving Evelyn by giving her that serum. I would have been destroying her. Peter sits with his back to the wall in the hallway. He looks up at me when I lean over him, his dark hair stuck to his forehead from the melted snow. "Did you reset her?" he says. "No," I say. "Didn't think you would have the nerve." "It's not about nerve. You know what? Whatever." I shake my head and hold up the vial of memory serum. "Are you still set on this?" He nods. "You could just do the work, you know," I say. "You could make better decisions, make a better life." "Yeah, I could," he says. "But I won't. We both know that." "I do know that. I know that change is difficult and comes slowly, and that it is the work of many days strung together in a long line until the origin of them is forgotten." He is afraid that he will not be able to put in that work, that he will squander those days, and that they will leave him worse off than he is now. And I understand that feeling. I understand being afraid of yourself. So I have him sit on one of the couches, and I ask him what he wants me to tell him about himself after his memories disappear like smoke. He just shakes his head. Nothing. He wants to retain nothing. Peter takes the vial with shaking hands and twists off the cap. The liquid trembles inside it, almost spilling over the lip. He holds it under his nose to smell it. "How much should I drink?" he says, and I think I hear his teeth chattering. "I don't think it makes a difference," I say.
"Okay. Well, here goes."
He lifts the vial up to the light like he is toasting me. When he touches it to his mouth, I say, "Be brave." Then he swallows, and I watch Peter disappear. The air outside tastes like ice. "Hey, Peter," I shout. My breaths turn to vapor. Peter stands by the doorway to the erudite headquarters, looking clueless. At the sound of his name, which I have told him at least 10 times since he drank the serum, he raises his eyebrows, pointing to his chest. Matthew told us people would be disoriented for a while after drinking the memory serum, but I didn't think disoriented meant stupid until now. I sigh. "Yes, that's you for the 11th time. Come on, let's go." I thought that when I looked at him after he drank the serum, I would still see the initiate who shoved a butter knife into Edward's eye, and the boy who tried to kill my girlfriend and all the other things he has done, stretching backward for as long as I've known him. But it's easier than I thought to see that he has no idea who he is anymore. His eyes still have that wide, innocent look, but this time, I believe it. Evelyn and I walk side by side, with Peter trotting behind us. The snow has stopped falling now, but enough is collected on the ground that it squeaks under my shoes. We walk to Millennium Park, where the mammoth bean sculpture reflects the moonlight, and then down a set of stairs. As we descend, Evelyn wraps her hand around my elbow to keep her balance, and we exchange a look. I wonder if she's as nervous as I am to face my father again. I wonder if she's nervous every time. At the bottom of the steps is a pavilion with two glass blocks, each one at least three times as tall as I am at either end. This is where we told Marcus and Johanna we would meet them, both parties armed, to be realistic, but even. They are already there. Johanna isn't holding a gun, but Marcus is, and he has it trained on Evelyn. I point the gun Evelyn gave me at him, just to be safe. I notice the planes of his skull showing through his shaved hair, and the jagged path his crooked nose carves down his face. "Tobias," Johanna says. She wears a coat in amity red, dusted with snowflakes. "What are you doing here?" "Trying to keep you all from killing each other," I say. "I'm surprised you're carrying a gun." I nod to the bulge in her coat pocket, the unmistakable contours of a weapon. "Sometimes you just have to take difficult measures to ensure peace," Johanna says. "I believe you agree with that as a principle." "We're not here to chat," Marcus says, looking at Evelyn. "You said you wanted to talk about a treaty." The past few weeks have taken something from him. I can see it in the turned down corners of his mouth, in the purple skin under his eyes. I see my own eyes set into his skull, and I think of my reflection in the fear landscape, how terrified I was, watching his skin spread over mine like a rash. I am still nervous that I will become him, even now, standing at odds with him with my mother at my side like I always dreamed I would when I was a child. But I don't think that I am still afraid. "Yes," Evelyn says. "I have some terms for both of us to agree to. I think you will find them fair. If you agree to them, I will step down and surrender whatever weapons I have that my people are not using for personal protection. I will leave the city and not return." Marcus laughs. I'm not sure if it's a mocking laugh or a disbelieving one. He's equally capable of either sentiment, an arrogant and deeply suspicious man. "Let her finish," Johanna says quietly, tucking her hands into her sleeves. "In return," Evelyn says, "you will not attack or try to seize control of the city. You will allow those people who wish to leave and seek a new life elsewhere to do so. You will allow those who choose to stay to vote on new leaders and a new social system. And most importantly, you, Marcus, will not be eligible to lead them." It is the only purely selfish term of the peace agreement. She told me she couldn't stand the thought of Marcus duping more people into following him, and I didn't argue with her. Johanna raises her eyebrows. I notice that she has pulled her hair back on both sides to reveal the scar in its entirety. She looks better that way, stronger when she is not hiding behind a curtain of hair, hiding who she is. "No deal," Marcus says. "I am the leader of these people."
"Marcus," Johanna says.
He ignores her.
"You don't get to decide whether I lead them or not because you have a grudge against me, Evelyn."
"Excuse me,"
Johanna says loudly.
"Marcus, what she is offering is too good to be true. We get everything we want without all the violence. How can you possibly say no?"
"Because I am the rightful leader of these people," Marcus says. "I am the leader of the Allegiant. I..."
"No, you are not," Johanna says calmly. "I am the leader of the Allegiant. And you are going to agree to this treaty, or I am going to tell them that you had a chance to end this conflict without bloodshed if you sacrificed your pride. And you said no."
Marcus's passive mask is gone, revealing the malicious face beneath it. But even he can't argue with Johanna, whose perfect calm and perfect threat have mastered him. He shakes his head, but doesn't argue again. I agree to your terms, Johanna says, and she holds out her hand, her footsteps squeaking in the snow. Evelyn removes her glove, fingertip by fingertip, reaches across the gap, and shakes. In the morning, we should gather everyone together and tell them the new plan, Johanna says. Can you guarantee a safe gathering? I'll do my best, Evelyn says. I check my watch. An hour has passed since Amar and Christina separated from us near the Hancock building, which means he probably knows that the serum virus didn't work. Or maybe he doesn't. Either way, I have to do what I came here to do. I have to find Zeke and his mother and tell them what happened to Uriah. I should go, I say to Evelyn. I have something else to take care of. But I'll pick you up from the city limits tomorrow afternoon.
That sounds good, Evelyn says.
And she rubs my arm briskly with a gloved hand like she used to when I came in from the cold as a child. You won't be back, I assume, Johanna says to me. You found a life for yourself on the outside? I have, I say. Good luck in here. The people outside, they're going to try to shut the city down. You should be ready for them. Johanna smiles.
I'm sure we can negotiate with them.
She offers me her hand and I shake it. I feel Marcus's eyes on me like an oppressive weight threatening to crush me. I force myself to look at him. Goodbye, I say to him. And I mean it. Hannah, Zeke's mother, has small feet that don't touch the ground when she sits in the easy chair in their living room. She is wearing a ragged black bathrobe and slippers, but the air she has with her hands folded in her lap and her eyebrows raised is so dignified that I feel like I am standing in front of a world leader. I glance at Zeke, who is rubbing his face with his fists to wake up. Amar and Christina found them, not among the other revolutionaries near the Hancock building, but in their family apartment in the pyre above Dauntless headquarters. I only found them because Christina thought to leave Peter and me a note with their location on the useless truck. Peter is waiting in the new van Evelyn found for us to drive to the bureau.
I'm sorry, I say. I don't know where to start.
You might begin with the worst,
Hannah says.
Like what exactly happened to my son?
He was seriously injured during an attack, I say. There was an explosion, and he was very close to it.
Oh, God,
Zeke says, and he rocks back and forth like his body wants to be a child again, soothed by motion as a child is. But Hannah just bends her head, hiding her face from me. Their living room smells like garlic and onion, maybe remnants from that night's dinner. I lean my shoulder into the white wall by the doorway. Hanging crookedly next to me is a picture of the family. Zeke as a toddler, Uriah as a baby balancing on his mother's lap. Their father's face is pierced in several places, nose and ear and lip, but his wide, bright smile and dark complexion are more familiar to me, because he passed them both to his sons.
He has been in a coma since then, I say.
And he isn't going to wake up,
Hannah says, her voice strained.
That is what you came to tell us, right?
Yes, I say. I came to collect you so that you can make a decision on his behalf.
A decision?
Zeke says.
You mean to unplug him or not?
Zeke, Hannah says, and she shakes her head.
He sinks back into the couch. The cushions seem to wrap around him.
Of course we don't want to keep him alive that way, Hannah says. He would want to move on, but we would like to go see him.
I nod. Of course.
But there's something else I should say.
The attack. It was a kind of uprising that involved some of the people from the place we were staying, and I participated in it.
I stare at the crack in the floorboards right in front of me, at the dust that has gathered there over time, and wait for a reaction. Any reaction. What greets me is only silence.
I didn't do what you asked me,
I said to Zeke. I didn't watch out for him the way I should have, and I'm sorry. I chance a look at him, and he is just sitting still, staring at the empty vase on the coffee table. It is painted with faded pink roses.
I think we need some time with this,
Hanna says. She clears her throat, but it doesn't help her tremulous voice. I wish I could give it to you, I say, but we're going back to the compound very soon, and you have to come with us.
All right,
Hanna says.
If you can wait outside, we will be there in 5 minutes.
The ride back to the compound is slow and dark. I watch the moon disappear and reappear behind the clouds as we bump over the ground. When we reach the outer limits of the city, it begins to snow again, large, light flakes that swirl in front of the headlights. I wonder if Triss is watching it sweep across the pavement and gather in piles by the airplanes. I wonder if she is living in a better world than the one I left, among people who no longer remember what it is to have pure genes. Christina leans forward to whisper in my ear.
So you did it? It worked?
I nod. In the rearview mirror, I see her touch her face with both hands, grinning into her palms. I know how she feels. Safe. We are all safe. Did you inoculate your family? I say.
Yep. We found them with the Allegiant in the Hancock building, she says. But the time for the reset has passed. It looks like Triss and Caleb stopped it.
Hanna and Zeke murmur to each other on the way, marveling at the strange, dark world we move through. Amar gives the basic explanation as we go, looking back at them instead of the road far too often for my comfort. I try to ignore my surges of panic as he almost veers into streetlights or road barriers and focus instead on the snow. I have always hated the emptiness that winter brings, the blank landscape and the stark difference between sky and ground, the way it transforms trees into skeletons and the city into a wasteland. Maybe this winter I can be persuaded otherwise. We drive past the fences and stop by the front doors, which are no longer manned by guards. We get out, and Zeke seizes his mother's hand to steady her as she shuffles through the snow. As we walk into the compound, I know for a fact that Caleb succeeded, because there is no one in sight. That can only mean that they have been reset, their memories forever altered. Where is everyone? Amar says. We walk through the abandoned security checkpoint without stopping. On the other side, I see Kara. The side of her face is badly bruised and there's a bandage on her head, but that's not what concerns me. What concerns me is the troubled look on her face. What is it? I say. Kara shakes her head. Where's Triss? I say.
I'm sorry, Tobias.
Sorry about what? Christina says roughly. Tell us what happened.
Triss went into the weapons lab instead of Caleb,
Kara says.
She survived the death serum and set off the memory serum, but she was shot, and she didn't survive. I'm so sorry.
Most of the time I can tell when people are lying. And this must be a lie, because Triss is still alive. Her eyes bright and her cheeks flushed and her small body full of power and strength, standing in a shaft of light in the atrium. Triss is still alive. She wouldn't leave me here alone. She wouldn't go to the weapons lab instead of Caleb.
No,
Christina says, shaking her head.
No way. There has to be some mistake.
Kara's eyes well up with tears. It's then that I realize, of course Triss would go into the weapons lab instead of Caleb. Of course she would. Christina yells something, but to me her voice sounds muffled, like I have submerged my head underwater. The details of Kara's face have also become difficult to see, the world smearing together into dull colors. All I can do is stand still. I feel like if I just stand still, I can stop it from being true. I can pretend that everything is all right. Christina hunches over, unable to support her own grief, and Kara embraces her. And all I'm doing is standing still. Chapter 52 Tobias. When her body first hit the net, all I registered was a gray blur. I pulled her across it, and her hand was small but warm. And then she stood before me, short and thin and plain and in all ways unremarkable, except that she had jumped first. The stiff had jumped first. Even I didn't jump first. Her eyes were so stern, so insistent. Beautiful. Chapter 53 Tobias. But that wasn't the first time I ever saw her. I saw her in the hallways at school, and at my mother's false funeral, and walking the sidewalks in the abnegation sector. I saw her, but I didn't see her. No one saw her the way she truly was until she jumped. I suppose a fire that burns that bright is not meant to last. Chapter 54 Tobias. I go to see her body. Sometime. I don't know how long it is after Kara tells me what happened. Christina and I walk shoulder to shoulder. We walk in Kara's footsteps. I don't remember the journey from the entrance to the morgue, really. Just a few smeared images and whatever sound I can make out through the barrier that has gone up inside my head. She lies on a table. And for a moment I think she's just sleeping, and when I touch her she will wake up and smile at me and press a kiss to my mouth. But when I touch her, she is cold. Her body stiff and unyielding. Christina sniffles and sobs. I squeeze Triss's hand, praying that if I do it hard enough I will send life back into her body and she will flush with color and wake up. I don't know how long it takes for me to realize that this isn't going to happen, that she is gone. But when I do, I feel all the strength go out of me, and I fall to my knees beside the table, and I think I cry then, or at least I want to, and everything inside me screams for just one more kiss, one more word, one more glance, one more. Chapter 55 In the days that follow, it's movement, not stillness, that helps to keep the grief at bay. So I walk the compound halls instead of sleeping. I watch everyone else recover from the memory serum that altered them permanently, as if from a great distance. Those lost in the memory serum haze are gathered into groups and given the truth, that human nature is complex, that all our genes are different, but neither damaged nor pure. They are also given the lie that their memories were erased because of a freak accident and that they were on the verge of lobbying the government for equality for GDs. I keep finding myself stifled by the company of others, then crippled by loneliness when I leave them. I am terrified, and I don't even know of what because I have lost everything already. My hands shake as I stop by the control room to watch the city on the screens. Johanna is arranging transportation for those who want to leave the city. They will come here to learn the truth. I don't know what will happen to those who remain in Chicago, and I'm not sure I care. I shove my hands into my pockets and watch for a few minutes, then walk away again, trying to match my footsteps to my heartbeat, or to avoid the cracks between the tiles. When I walk past the entrance, I see a small group of people gathered by the stone sculpture, one of them in a wheelchair. Nita. I walk past the useless security barrier and stand at a distance watching them. Reggie steps on the stone slab and opens a valve in the bottom of the water tank. The drops turn into a stream of water, and soon water gushes out of the tank, splattering all over the slab, soaking the bottom of Reggie's pants. Tobias? I shudder a little. It's Caleb. I turn away from the voice, searching for an escape route. Wait, please, he says. I don't want to look at him, to measure how much or how little he grieves for her. And I don't want to think about how she died for such a miserable coward, about how he wasn't worth her life. Still, I do look at him, wondering if I can see some of her in his face, still hungry for her even now that I know she's gone. His hair is unwashed and unkempt, his green eyes bloodshot, his mouth twitching into a frown. He does not look like her.
"I don't mean to bother you," he says, "but I have something to tell you. Something she told me to tell you before."
"Just get on with it," I say, before he tries to finish the sentence.
"She told me that if she didn't survive, I should tell you."
Caleb chokes and pulls himself up straight, fighting off tears.
"That she didn't want to leave you."
I should feel something. Hearing her last words to me, shouldn't I? I feel nothing. I feel farther away than ever. "Yeah," I say harshly. "Then why did she? Why didn't she let you die?"
"You think I'm not asking myself that question?"
Caleb says. "She loved me. Enough to hold me at gunpoint so she could die for me. I have no idea why. But that's just the way it is." He walks away without letting me respond. And it's probably better that way, because I can't think of anything to say that is equal to my anger. I blink away tears and sit down on the ground, right in the middle of the lobby. I know why she wanted to tell me that she didn't want to leave me. She wanted me to know that this was not another erudite headquarters. Not a lie told to make me sleep while she went to die. Not an act of unnecessary self-sacrifice. I grind the heels of my hands into my eyes like I can push my tears back into my skull. "No crying," I chastise myself. If I let a little of the emotion out, all of it will come out, and it will never end. Sometime later, I hear voices nearby, Kara and Peter.
"This sculpture was a symbol of change," she says to him. "Gradual change. But now they are taking it down."
"Oh, really?" Peter sounds eager. "Why?"
I'll explain later if that's okay," Kara says. "Do you remember how to get back to the dormitory?"
"Yep."
"Then go back there for a while. Someone will be there to help you."
Kara walks over to me, and I cringe in anticipation of her voice. But all she does is sit next to me on the ground, her hands folded in her lap, her back straight. Alert but relaxed, she watches the sculpture where Reggie stands under the gushing water.
"You don't have to stay here," I say.
"I don't have anywhere to be," she says. "And the quiet is nice."
So we sit side by side, staring at the water in silence. "There you are," Christina says, jogging toward us. Her face is swollen and her voice is listless, like a heavy sigh.
"Come on, it's time. They're unplugging him."
I shudder at the word but push myself to my feet anyway. Hannah and Zeke have been hovering over Uriah's body since we got here, their fingers finding his, their eyes searching for life. But there is no life left, just the machine beating his heart. Kara walks behind Christina and me as we go toward the hospital. I haven't slept in days, but I don't feel tired. Not in the way I normally do, though my body aches as I walk. Christina and I don't speak, but I know our thoughts are the same, fixed on Uriah, on his last breaths. We make it to the observation window outside Uriah's room, and Evelyn is there. Amar picked her up in my stead a few days ago. She tries to touch my shoulder, and I yank it away, not wanting to be comforted. Inside the room, Zeke and Hannah stand on either side of Uriah. Hannah is holding one of his hands, and Zeke is holding the other. A doctor stands near the heart monitor, a clipboard outstretched, held out not to Hannah or Zeke, but to David, sitting in his wheelchair, hunched and dazed like all the others who have lost their memories. What is he doing there? I feel like all my muscles and bones and nerves are on fire.
He's still technically the leader of the Bureau, at least until they replace him,
Kara says from behind me.
Tobias, he doesn't remember anything. The man you knew doesn't exist anymore. He's as good as dead. That man doesn't remember kill...
Shut up! I snap. David signs the clipboard and turns around, pushing himself toward the door. It opens and I can't stop myself. I lunge toward him, and only Evelyn's wiry frame stops me from wrapping my hands around his throat. He gives me a strange look and pushes himself down the hallway as I press against my mother's arm, which feels like a bar across my shoulders.
Tobias, Evelyn says, calm down.
Why didn't someone lock him up? I demand, and my eyes are too blurry to see out of.
Because he still works for the government, Kara says. Just because they've declared it an unfortunate accident doesn't mean they fired everyone. And the government isn't going to lock him up just because he killed a rebel under duress.
A rebel, I repeat. That's all she is now?
Was,
Kara says softly.
And no, of course not. But that's what the government sees her as.
I'm about to respond, but Christina interrupts. Guys, they're doing it. In Uriah's room, Zeke and Hannah join their free hands over Uriah's body. I see Hannah's lips moving, but I can't tell what she's saying.
Do the Dauntless have prayers for the dying?
The abnegation react to death with silence and service, not words. I find my anger ebbing away, and I'm lost in muffled grief again. This time not just for Triss, but for Uriah, whose smile is burned into my memory. My friend's brother and then my friend too, though not for long enough to let his humor work its way into me. Not for long enough. The doctor flips some switches, his clipboard clutched to his stomach, and the machines stop breathing for Uriah. Zeke's shoulders shake, and Hannah squeezes his hand tightly until her knuckles go white. Then she says something, and her hands spring open, and she steps back from Uriah's body, letting him go. I move away from the window, walking at first, and then running, pushing my way through the hallways, careless, blind, empty. Chapter 56. The next day I take a truck from the compound. The people there are still recovering from their memory loss, so no one tries to stop me. I drive over the railroad tracks toward the city, my eyes wandering over the skyline but not really taking it in. When I reach the fields that separate the city from the outside world, I press down the accelerator. The truck crushes dying grass and snow beneath its tires, and soon the ground turns to the pavement in the abnegation sector, and I barely feel the passage of time. The streets are all the same, but my hands and feet know where to go, even if my mind doesn't bother to guide them. I pull up to the house near the stop sign with the cracked front walk. My house. I walk through the front door and up the stairs, still with that muffled feeling in my ears, like I'm drifting far away from the world. People talk about the pain of grief, but I don't know what they mean. To me, grief is a devastating numbness, every sensation dulled. I press my palm to the panel covering the mirror upstairs and push it aside. Though the light of sunset is orange, creeping across the floor and illuminating my face from below, I have never looked paler. The circles under my eyes have never been more pronounced. I have spent the past few days somewhere between sleeping and waking, not quite able to manage either extreme. I plug the hair clippers into the outlet near the mirror. The right guard is already in place, so all I have to do is run it through my hair, bending my ears down to protect them from the blade, turning my head to check the back of my neck for places I might have missed. The shorn hair falls on my feet and shoulders, itching whatever bare skin it finds. I run my hand over my head to make sure it's even, but I don't need to check. Not really. I learned to do this myself when I was young. I spend a lot of time brushing it from my shoulders and feet, then sweeping it into a dustpan. When I finish, I stand in front of the mirror again, and I can see the edges of my tattoo, the dauntless flame. I take the vial of memory serum from my pocket. I know that one vial will erase most of my life, but it will target memories, not facts. I will still know how to write, how to speak, how to put together a computer, because that data was stored in different parts of my brain. But I won't remember anything else. The experiment is over. Johanna successfully negotiated with the government, David's superiors, to allow the former faction members to stay in the city, provided they are self-sufficient, submit to the government's authority, and allow outsiders to come in and join them, making Chicago just another metropolitan area like Milwaukee. The Bureau, once in charge of the experiment, will now keep order in Chicago's city limits. It will be the only metropolitan area in the country governed by people who don't believe in genetic damage. A kind of paradise. Matthew told me he hopes people from the fringe will trickle in to fill all the empty spaces and find there a life more prosperous than the one they left. All that I want is to become someone new. In this case, Tobias Johnson, son of Evelyn Johnson. Tobias Johnson may have lived a dull and empty life, but he is at least a whole person, not this fragment of a person that I am, too damaged by pain to become anything useful. Matthew told me you stole some of the memory serum in a truck, says a voice at the end of the hallway. Christina's.
I have to say, I didn't really believe him.
I must not have heard her enter the house through the muffle. Even her voice sounds like it's traveling through water to reach my ears, and it takes me a few seconds to make sense of what she says. When I do, I look at her and say, "Then why did you come? If you didn't believe him."
"Just in case," she says, starting toward me. "Plus, I wanted to see the city one more time before it all changes. Give me that vial, Tobias."
"No." I fold my fingers over it to protect it from her. "This is my decision, not yours." Her dark eyes widen, and her face is radiant with sunlight. It makes every strand of her thick, dark hair gleam orange like it's on fire.
"This is not your decision," she says. "This is the decision of a coward. And you're a lot of things for, but not a coward. Never."
"Maybe I am now," I answer passively. "Things have changed. I'm all right with it."
"No, you're not."
I feel so exhausted, all I can do is roll my eyes.
"You can't become a person she would hate,"
Christina says, quietly this time.
"And she would have hated this."
Anger stampedes through me, hot and lively, and the muffled feeling around my ears falls away, making even this quiet, abnegation street sound loud. I shudder with the force of it. "Shut up!" I yell. "Shut up! You don't know what she would hate. You didn't know her. You..."
"I know enough," she snaps. "I know she wouldn't want you to erase her from your memory like she didn't even matter to you."
I lunge toward her, pinning her shoulder to the wall, and lean closer to her face.
"If you dare suggest that again," I say, "I'll..."
"You'll what?" Christina shoves me back hard. "Hurt me? You know, there's a word for big, strong men who attack women, and it's coward."
I remember my father's screams filling the house, and his hand around my mother's throat, slamming her into walls and doors. I remember watching from my doorway, my hand wrapped around the doorframe. And I remember hearing quiet sobs through her bedroom door, how she locked it so I couldn't get in. I step back and slump against the wall, letting my body collapse into it.
"I'm sorry,"
I say.
"I know,"
she answers. We stand still for a few seconds, just looking at each other. I remember hating her the first time I met her, because she was a candor. Because words just dribbled out of her mouth unchecked, careless. But over time, she showed me who she really was. A forgiving friend, faithful to the truth, brave enough to take action. I can't help but like her now. Can't help but see what Triss saw in her.
I know how it feels to want to forget everything, she says. I also know how it feels for someone you love to get killed for no reason, and to want to trade all your memories of them for just a moment's peace.
She wraps her hand around mine, which is wrapped around the vial.
I didn't know Will long, she says, but he changed my life. He changed me. And I know Triss changed you even more.
The hard expression she wore a moment ago melts away, and she touches my shoulders lightly.
The person you became with her is worth being, she says. If you swallow that serum, you'll never be able to find your way back to him.
The tears come again, like when I saw Triss's body. And this time, pain comes with them, hot and sharp in my chest. I clutch the vial with my fist, desperate for the relief it offers, the protection from the pain of every memory clawing inside me like an animal. Christina puts her arms around my shoulders, and her embrace only makes the pain worse, because it reminds me of every time Triss's thin arms slipped around me, uncertain at first, but then stronger, more confident, more sure of herself and of me. It reminds me that no embrace will ever feel the same again, because no one will ever be like her again, because she's gone. She's gone, and crying feels so useless, so stupid. But it's all I can do. Christina holds me upright and doesn't say a word for a long time. Eventually, I pull away, but her hands stay on my shoulders, warm and rough with calluses. Maybe just as skin on a hand grows tougher after pain and repetition, a person does too. But I don't want to become a calloused man. There are other kinds of people in this world. There's the kind like Triss, who after suffering and betrayal could still find enough love to lay down her life instead of her brother's. Or the kind like Kara, who could still forgive the person who shot her brother in the head. Or Christina, who lost friend after friend but still decided to stay open, to make new ones. Appearing in front of me is another choice, brighter and stronger than the ones I gave myself. My eyes opening, I offer the vial to her. She takes it and pockets it. I know Zeke's still weird around you, she says, slinging an arm across my shoulders. But I can be your friend in the meantime. We can even exchange bracelets if you want, like the Amity girls used to. I don't think that will be necessary. We walk down the stairs and out to the street together. The sun has slipped behind the buildings of Chicago, and in the distance I hear a train rushing over the rails. But we are moving away from this place and all that it has meant to us. And that is all right. There are so many ways to be brave in this world. Sometimes bravery involves laying down your life for something bigger than yourself, or for someone else. Sometimes it involves giving up everything you have ever known, or everyone you have ever loved for the sake of something greater. But sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it is nothing more than gritting your teeth through pain and the work of every day, the slow walk toward a better life. That is the sort of bravery I must have now. Epilogue. 2.5 years later. Evelyn stands at the place where two worlds meet. Tire tracks are worn into the ground now from the frequent coming and going of people from the fringe moving in and out, or people from the former bureau compound commuting back and forth. Her bag rests against her leg in one of the wells in the earth. She lifts a hand to greet me when I'm close. When she gets into the truck, she kisses my cheek, and I let her. I feel a smile creep across my face, and I let it stay there. Welcome back, I say. The agreement, when I offered it to her more than 2 years ago, and when she made it again with Johanna shortly after, was that she would leave the city. Now, So much has changed in Chicago that I don't see the harm in her coming back, and neither does she. Though 2 years have passed, she looks younger, her face fuller and her smile wider. The time away has done her good.
How are you? She says.
I'm okay, I say. We're scattering her ashes today. I glance at the urn perched on the back seat like another passenger. For a long time I left Triss's ashes in the bureau morgue, not sure what kind of funeral she would want, and not sure I could make it through one. But today would be choosing day if we still had factions, and it's time to take a step forward, even if it's a small one. Evelyn puts a hand on my shoulder and looks out at the fields. The crops that were once isolated to the areas around the Amity headquarters have spread, and continue to spread through all the grassy spaces around the city. Sometimes I miss the desolate, empty land. But right now I don't mind driving through the rows and rows of corn or wheat. I see people among the plants, checking the soil with handheld devices designed by former bureau scientists. They wear red and blue and green and purple.
What's it like?
Living without factions, Evelyn says. It's very ordinary, I say. I smile at her. You'll love it. I take Evelyn to my apartment just north of the river. It's on one of the lower floors, but through the abundant windows I can see a wide stretch of buildings. I was one of the first settlers in New Chicago, so I got to choose where I lived. Zeke, Shauna, Christina, Amar, and George opted to live in the higher floors of the Hancock building, and Caleb and Kara both moved back to the apartments near Millennium Park. But I came here because it was beautiful, and because it was nowhere near either of my old homes. My neighbor is a history expert. He came from the fringe, I say, as I search my pockets for my keys. He calls Chicago the fourth city because it was destroyed by fire ages ago, and then again by the Purity War, and now we're on the fourth attempt at settlement here.
The fourth city,
Evelyn says as I push the door open.
I like it.
There's hardly any furniture inside. Just a couch and a table, some chairs, a kitchen. Sunlight winks in the windows of the building across the marshy river. Some of the former bureau scientists are trying to restore the river and the lake to their former glory, but it will be a while. Change, like healing, takes time. Evelyn drops her bag on the couch.
Thank you for letting me stay with you for a little while. I promise I'll find another place soon.
No problem, I say. I feel nervous about her being here, poking through my meager possessions, shuffling down my hallways, but we can't stay distant forever. Not when I promised her that I would try to bridge this gap between us.
George says he needs some help training a police force, Evelyn says. You didn't offer?
No, I say. I told you, I'm done with guns.
That's right. You're using your words now, Evelyn says, wrinkling her nose. I don't trust politicians, you know.
You'll trust me because I'm your son, I say. Anyway, I'm not a politician. Not yet, anyway, just an assistant. She sits at the table and looks around, twitchy and spry like a cat.
Do you know where your father is?
She says. I shrug. Someone told me he left. I didn't ask where he went. She rests her chin on her hand.
There's nothing you wanted to say to him? Nothing at all?
No, I say. I twirl my keys around my finger. I just wanted to leave him behind me, where he belongs. 2 years ago, when I stood across from him in the park with the snow falling all around us, I realized that just as attacking him in front of the Dauntless and the Merciless Mart didn't make me feel better about the pain he caused me, yelling at him or insulting him wouldn't either. There was only one option left, and it was letting go. Evelyn gives me a strange, searching look, then crosses the room and opens the bag she left on the couch. She takes out an object made of blue glass. It looks like falling water, suspended in time. I remember when she gave it to me. I was young, but not too young to realize that it was a forbidden object in the Abnegation faction, a useless and therefore a self-indulgent one. I asked her what purpose it served, and she told me,
"It doesn't do anything obvious, but it might be able to do something here."
Then she touched her hand to her heart.
"Beautiful things sometimes do."
For years, it was a symbol of my quiet defiance, my small refusal to be an obedient, deferent, abnegation child, and a symbol of my mother's defiance, too, even though I believed she was dead. I hid it under my bed, and the day I decided to leave abnegation, I put it on my desk so my father could see it, see my strength, and hers.
"When you were gone,
this reminded me of you," she says, clutching the glass to her stomach.
"Reminded me of how brave you were. Always have been."
She smiles a little.
"I thought you might keep it here. I intended it for you, after all."
I wouldn't trust my voice to remain steady if I spoke, so I just smile back and nod. The spring air is cold, but I leave the windows open in the truck so I can feel it in my chest, so it stings my fingertips, a reminder of the lingering winter. I stop by the train platform near the Merciless Mart and take the urn out of the back seat. It's silver and simple, no engravings. I didn't choose it. Christina did. I walk down the platform toward the group that has already gathered. Christina stands with Zeke and Shauna, who sits in the wheelchair with a blanket over her lap. She has a better wheelchair now, one without handles on the back so she can maneuver it more easily. Matthew stands on the platform with his toes over the edge. "Hi," I say, standing at Shauna's shoulder. Christina smiles at me, and Zeke claps me on the shoulder. Uriah died only days after Triss, but Zeke and Hannah said their goodbyes just weeks after, scattering his ashes in the chasm amid the clatter of all their friends and family. We screamed his name into the echo chamber of the pit. Still, I know that Zeke is remembering him today, just as the rest of us are, even though this last act of dauntless bravery is for Triss.
"Got something to show you," Shauna says,
and she tosses the blanket aside, revealing complicated metal braces on her legs. They go all the way up to her hips and wrap around her belly like a cage. She smiles at me, and with a gear-grinding sound, her feet shift to the ground in front of the chair, and it fits and starts. She stands. Despite the serious occasion, I smile.
"Well, look at that," I say. "I've forgotten how tall you are."
"Caleb and his lab buddies made them for me," she says. "Still getting the hang of it, but they say I might be able to run someday." "Nice," I say. "Where is he, anyway?"
"He and Amar will meet us at the end of the line," she says. "Someone has to be there to catch the first person."
"He's still sort of a pansy cake," Zeke says, "but I'm coming around to him." "Hmm," I say, not committing. "The truth is I've made my peace with Caleb, but I still can't be around him for long. His gestures, his inflections, his manner, they are hers. They make him into just a whisper of her, and that is not enough of her. But it is also far too much. I would say more, but the train is coming. It charges toward us on the polished rails, then squeals as it slows to a stop in front of the platform. A head leans out the window of the first car where the controls are. It's Kara, her hair in a tight braid.
"Get on,"
she says. Shauna sits in the chair again and pushes herself through the doorway. Matthew, Christina, and Zeke follow. I get on last, offering the urn to Shauna to hold, and stand in the doorway, my hand clutching the handle. The train starts again, building speed with each second, and I hear it churning over the tracks and whistling over the rails, and I feel the power of it rising inside me. The air whips across my face and presses my clothes to my body, and I watch the city sprawl out in front of me, the buildings lit by the sun. It's not the same as it used to be, but I got over that a long time ago. All of us have found new places. Kara and Caleb work in the laboratories at the compound, which are now a small segment of the Department of Agriculture that works to make agriculture more efficient, capable of feeding more people. Matthew works in psychiatric research somewhere in the city, The last time I asked him, he was studying something about memory. Christina works in an office that relocates people from the fringe who want to move into the city. Zeke and Amar are policemen, and George trains the police force, dauntless jobs, I call them. And I'm assistant to one of our city's representatives in government, Johanna Reyes. I stretch my arm out to grasp the other handle and lean out of the car as it turns, almost dangling over the street two stories below me. I feel a thrill in my stomach, the fear thrill, the true dauntless love. "Hey," Christina says, standing beside me. "How's your mother?" "Fine," I say. "We'll see, I guess." "Are you going to zipline?" I watch the track dip down in front of us, going all the way to street level. "Yes," I say. "I think Triss would want me to try it at least once." Saying her name still gives me a little twinge of pain, a pinch that lets me know her memory is still dear to me. Christina watches the rails ahead of us and leans her shoulder into mine just for a few seconds.
"I think you're right."
My memories of Triss, some of the most powerful memories I have dulled with time, as memories do, and they no longer sting as they used to. Sometimes I actually enjoy going over them in my mind, though not often. Sometimes I go over them with Christina, and she listens better than I expected her to, candor smartmouth that she is. Kara guides the train to a stop, and I hop onto the platform. At the top of the stairs, Shauna gets out of the chair and works her way down the steps with the braces, one at a time. Matthew and I carry her empty chair after her, which is cumbersome and heavy, but not impossible to manage. "Any updates from Peter?" I ask Matthew as we reach the bottom of the stairs. After Peter emerged from the memory serum haze, some of the sharper, harsher aspects of his personality returned, though not all of them. I lost touch with him after that. I don't hate him anymore, but that doesn't mean I have to like him. "He's in Milwaukee," Matthew says. "I don't know what he's doing, though."
"He's working in an office somewhere," Kara says from the bottom of the stairs.
She has the urn cradled in her arms, taken from Shauna's lap on the way off the train.
"I think it's good for him."
"I always thought he would go join the GD rebels in the fringe," Zeke says. "Shows you what I know."
"He's different now," Kara says with a shrug.
"There are still GD rebels in the fringe who believe that another war is the only way to get the change we want. I fall more on the side that wants to work for change without violence. I've had enough violence to last me a lifetime, and I bear it still. Not in scars on my skin, but in the memories that rise up in my mind when I least want them to. My father's fist colliding with my jaw. My gun raised to execute Eric. The abnegation bodies sprawled across the streets of my old home. We walk the streets to the zip line. The factions are gone, but this part of the city has more dauntless than any other, recognizable still by their pierced faces and tattooed skin, though no longer by the colors they wear, which are sometimes garish. Some wander the sidewalks with us, but most are at work. Everyone in Chicago is required to work if they're able. Ahead of me I see the Hancock Building bending into the sky, its base wider than its top. The black girders chase one another up to the roof, crossing, tightening, and expanding. I haven't been this close in a long time. We enter the lobby, with its gleaming, polished floors and its walls smeared with bright, dauntless graffiti, left here by the building's residents as a kind of relic. This is a dauntless place, because they are the ones who embraced it for its height, and a part of me also suspects, for its loneliness. The dauntless liked to fill empty spaces with their noise. It's something I liked about them. Zeke jabs the elevator button with his index finger. We pile in, and Kara presses number 99. I close my eyes as the elevator surges upward. I can almost see the space opening up beneath my feet, a shaft of darkness, and only a foot of solid ground between me and the sinking, dropping, plummeting. The elevator shudders as it stops, and I cling to the wall to steady myself as the door opens. Zeke touches my shoulder.
"Don't worry, man. We did this all the time, remember?"
I nod. Air rushes through the gap in the ceiling, and above me is the sky, bright blue. I shuffle with the others toward the ladder, too numb with fear to make my feet move any faster. I find the ladder with my fingertips and focus on one rung at a time. Above me, Shauna maneuvers awkwardly up the ladder, using mostly the strength of her arms. I asked Tori once while I was getting the symbols tattooed on my back if she thought we were the last people left in the world.
Maybe,
was all she said. I don't think she liked to think about it. But up here, on the roof, it is possible to believe that we are the last people left anywhere. I stare at the buildings along the marsh front, and my chest tightens, squeezes like it's about to collapse into itself. Zeke runs across the roof to the zip line and attaches one of the man-sized slings to the steel cable. He locks it so it won't slide down, and looks at the group of us expectantly.
Christina, he says, it's all you.
Christina stands near the sling, tapping her chin with a finger.
What do you think? Face up or backward?
Backward, Matthew says.
I want it to go face up so I don't wet my pants and I don't want you copying me.
Going face up will only make that more likely to happen, you know, Christina says. So go ahead and do it so I can start calling you wet pants.
Christina gets in the sling feet first, belly down, so she'll watch the building get smaller as she travels. I shudder. I can't watch. I close my eyes as Christina travels farther and farther away, and even as Matthew and then Shauna do the same thing. I can hear their cries of joy like bird calls on the wind.
Your turn, Four,
says Zeke. I shake my head.
Come on, Kara says. Better to get it over with, right?
No, I say. You go, please. She offers me the urn, then takes a deep breath. I hold the urn against my stomach. The metal is warm from where so many people have touched it. Kara climbs into the sling, unsteady, and Zeke straps her in. She crosses her arms over her chest and he sends her out, over Lakeshore Drive, over the city. I don't hear anything from her, not even a gasp. Then it's just Zeke and me left, staring at each other.
I don't think I can do it, I say,
and though my voice is steady, my body is shaking.
Of course you can, he says. You're Four. Dauntless legend. You can face anything.
I cross my arms an inch closer to the edge of the roof. Even though I'm several feet away, I feel my body pitching over the edge, and I shake my head again and again and again.
Hey, Zeke puts his hands on my shoulders. This isn't about you, remember? It's about her. Doing something she would have liked to do. Something she would have been proud of you for doing, right?
That's it. I can't avoid this. I can't back out now. Not when I still remember her smile as she climbed the Ferris wheel with me, or the hard set of her jaw as she faced fear after fear in the simulations. How did she get in?
Face first, Zeke says.
All right. I hand him the urn. Put this behind me, okay? And open up the top. I climb into the sling, my hands shaking so much I can barely grip the sides. Zeke tightens the straps across my back and legs, then wedges the urn behind me, facing out so the ashes will spread. I stare down Lakeshore Drive, swallowing bile, and start to slide. Suddenly, I want to take it back, but it's too late. I am already diving toward the ground. I'm screaming so loud I want to cover my own ears. I feel the scream living inside me, filling my chest, throat, and head. The wind stings my eyes, but I force them open. And in my moment of blind panic, I understand why she did it this way, face first. It was because it made her feel like she was flying, like she was a bird. I can still feel the emptiness beneath me, and it is like the emptiness inside me, like a mouth about to swallow me. I realize then that I have stopped moving. The last bits of ash float on the wind like gray snowflakes and then disappear. The ground is only a few feet below me, close enough to jump down. The others have gathered there in a circle, their arms clasped to form a net of bone and muscle to catch me in. I press my face to the sling and laugh. I toss the empty urn down to them, then twist my arms behind my back to undo the straps holding me in. I drop into my friend's arms like a stone. They catch me, their bones pinching at my back and legs, and lower me to the ground. There is an awkward silence as I stare at the Hancock building in wonder, and no one knows what to say. Caleb smiles at me, cautious. Christina blinks tears from her eyes and says,
"Oh, Zeke's on his way."
Zeke is hurtling toward us in a black sling. At first it looks like a dot, then a blob, and then a person swathed in black. He crows with joy as he eases to a stop, and I reach across to grab Amar's forearm. On my other side, I grasp a pale arm that belongs to Kara. She smiles at me, and there is some sadness in her smile. Zeke's shoulder hits our arms hard, and he smiles wildly as he lets us cradle him like a child.
"That was nice. Want to go again, Four?" he says.
I don't hesitate before answering. "Absolutely not." We walk back to the train in a loose cluster. Shauna walks with her braces, Zeke pushing the empty wheelchair, and exchanges small talk with Amar. Matthew, Kara, and Caleb walk together, talking about something that has them all excited, kindred spirits that they are. Christina sidles up next to me and puts a hand on my shoulder.
"Happy choosing day," she says. "I'm going to ask you how you really are, and you're going to give me an honest answer."
We talk like this sometimes, giving each other orders. Somehow she has become one of the best friends I have, despite our frequent bickering. "I'm all right," I say. "It's hard." "It always will be."
"I know,"
she says. We walk at the back of the group, past the still abandoned buildings with their dark windows, over the bridge that spans the river marsh.
"Yeah, sometimes life really sucks," she says. "But you know what I'm holding on for?"
I raise my eyebrows. She raises hers too, mimicking me.
"The moments that don't suck," she says. "The trick is to notice them when they come around."
Then she smiles and I smile back, and we climb the stairs to the train platform, side by side. Since I was young, I have always known this. Life damages us, every one. We can't escape that damage. But now I am also learning this. We can be mended. We mend each other.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Allegiant by Veronica Roth. This program was performed by Emma Galvin and Aaron Stanford. It was produced and directed by Caitlin Gehring. Post-production by John Marshall Media. Recorded at Glenn Gould Studio in Toronto and at John Marshall Media, New York City. Text copyright 2013 by Veronica Roth. Production copyright 2013 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.